Okay, with that, let's kick off with agenda paper 2 about forecasts of future economic conditions. And I think, Hannah, are you going to tee that up for us?
Will do. Good morning, everybody. Our first paper this morning is agenda paper 2, which is about incorporating events and forecasts of economic conditions when we apply the new impairment requirements in IFRS 9. The first thing I'd like to do is just to highlight the overall objective in the standard about the impairment requirements. As stated in the standard, the objective is to recognise lifetime expected credit losses for all financial instruments for which there have been significant increases in credit risk since initial recognition. This is whether they're assessed on an individual or collective basis, and considering all reasonable and supportable information, including that which is forward-looking. And that's taken from the words in the standard. And so that's to say that when we need to look at forward-looking information that should be considered both when we're assessing whether there's been a significant increase in credit risk since initial recognition, and also when we're actually measuring our expected credit losses, either on a 12-month or a lifetime basis. In this particular issue, the submitter notes that for practical reasons, forecasts of future economic conditions developed, say, in November, might be used as a basis for determining expected credit losses at the reporting date at the end of December, for example. And so the issue raised is to what extent should events and new information be taken into account when applying the impairment requirements, when the information becomes available, firstly, after the initial economic forecasts have been made, but before the reporting period end, which is issue one in the paper. And secondly, when the new information comes to light between the reporting period end and the date of signing the financial statements, that is after our year end, which is issue two in the paper. If we look at issue one, where we have new information arising before the reporting period date, we note that IFRS 9 requires the use of information that's reasonably available at the reporting date without undue cost or effort. And so therefore, subject to materiality considerations, reasonable and supportable new information that does become available before the reporting date is required by the standard to be taken into consideration when you're applying the impairment requirements. Looking at issue two, which is about the extent to which information that becomes available after the reporting period end should be considered, here we note that IFRS 9 does not specifically require events and new information that becomes available after the reporting date to be reflected in the measurement of expected credit losses at the reporting date. However, there is an overlay that's applied on us by IS 10, or standard on events after the reporting period, which does require entities to look at whether the information that becomes available after the reporting period end is an adjusting or a non-adjusting post-balance sheet event. And that's whether that information is indicative of conditions that existed at the reporting period end. There haven't been any changes to the principles in IS 10 throughout the development of IFRS 9, although IFRS 9 did revise the example, one of the relevant examples in IS 10, which is to note that the bankruptcy of a customer that occurs after the reporting period would usually confirm that the customer was credit impaired at the end of the reporting period. It's useful to note that a financial instrument is credit impaired when one or more events that have a detrimental impact on the estimated cash flows has occurred. So it's when we've reached stage three in the process for the impairment line. Inherently, the application of IS 10 will require some judgments when depending on the specific facts and circumstances, and so I don't think there's necessarily a complete black and white answer, but I'd be interested to hear your views both in respect of issue one, when you're looking at event information before the period end, and issue two, which is when we're looking at information that becomes available after the period end.
Open up for comments. Bill?
Okay, thank you. So, Bill Hayward, what I should have mentioned in the introduction to help expedite the process today, the non-observer members of the ITG have allocated topics between them so that there'll be a preparer and then an an audit representative who will respond, and then other ITG members will add comments to the extent relevant or necessary. So thank you, Hannah, and I think the first thing I would just say is thought the analysis in the paper was well presented, well prepared. Essentially, we see this as a timing issue, and economic. If we think about the economic conditions, they're unlikely to change in the relative short term. But as the example illustrates, it may be that more up-to-date figures become available, and when considering how to deal with it, also looking at widening to sort of other macro events or circumstances that might impact. And you've made the reference to the basis for conclusions in that regard. So I think you've touched on a couple of other important points about information being reasonable and supportable, and would expect to be taken into account. And as you've clarified, IAS 10 hasn't changed, and deals with what existed or arose after the reporting date. So it makes that very clear. And I think the other point, which I would have just brought out from your comments and the research, was really around IAS 8 is bringing it back, talking about loan loss allowances being reasonable estimates. And I think that's an important point to sort of bear in mind throughout this. So how would you deal with this in practice? And I think the first thing I would say is you'd make sure that you've got a proper process to deal with it and appropriate governance so that it's transparent and you can see clearly what you've taken into consideration and what you've taken, you know, what's been excluded. Internally to our shop, and I know other institutions similarly have a sort of a post-model adjustments committee, which is formally structured to deal with these sort of circumstances. And then recognize, you know, that's important, because recognizing that there will be some lags, and you make adjustments if it's individually or collectively significant. Policy, make sure that you do that on a consistent basis, period to period. And an important point is you don't want to penalise good risk management in doing this. So through good risk management, you'll be monitoring these sorts of changes. So pre-reporting date, I think we would deal with it as you've got to get the numbers materially right, as you've said, and therefore, if that leads to a change in your estimate, then you know you would just have to deal with that as you go along. Post-reporting date, as you've said, is slightly more interesting and slightly more challenging, because, as you've said, you have to first of all make the assessment: is it an adjusting or a non-adjusting event? So things like changes in unemployment figures or house price collapse, an example we've sort of discussed in the UK working groups that I've been party to, where there was the discussion around the Scottish referendum. So if that would cause to a change in your assessment. And I think where we landed on that is it really does depend on the circumstances, which is linking it back to paragraph 34 of IAS 8. I'm conscious I feel like a technical accountant in responding to this. I apologise for that. But
I don't need to apologise in this room for that.
But I think, you know, Hannah makes the point very clearly that, you know, IAS 8 and IAS 10 haven't changed. And so to that extent, you would use those as sort of reference points. to the other sort of two other points, I guess I would sort of just call out, and then I'll sort of hand over. Is the first one is that you would liken it to fair value accounting, where you had a change in interest rates or something like that, which became apparent post the reporting date. You wouldn't go back and restate your fair value accounts, and so I don't believe it's the intention to, you know, to do that on IFRS 9. So I think there's looking for consistency and comparability there. The only other sort of point I would bring out, and this is an important operational consideration, and I say it very conscious that there are a number of audit representatives in the room and on the ITG, and I think the note of caution is whether you make that adjustment post balance sheet date or not is going to depend on the nature of the event, rather than having to almost prove a negative that you have to monitor every event and then prove that it's not material in some way, because you would inadvertently create quite a burden on the preparers and indeed the audit firms to do something. So I think there has to be that sort of note of caution in there, that you'll take into consideration those changes and then you'll rely on sort of, if you will, management judgment and the normal sort of monitoring controls that you've got to understand whether or not it's one you take further.
Can I just follow up on something, a point you made there, Bill? When you talk about the nature of the event, I think that's important, because I think what you meant, and hopefully I'm not putting words in your mouth, if I was to think about the Scottish referendum, and let's say that that was occurring after the 31st of December, that doesn't confirm or give you information about a situation as at the 31st of December, because that's an event that occurred afterwards. So it's not like we're asking you to hunt for all of that stuff, because that would be a fundamental change to the way that we think about things.
Right.
Where it gets a little more grey is if it's information which is confirming the situation as at the reporting date.
Good. Correct. And the bankruptcy example that Hannah cited, I would be extremely surprised if that account wasn't already in stage two and therefore subject to lifetime. If it's not, it's pointing to a failing elsewhere, which I don't think the standard is designed to capture.
Okay, thank you. George?
So I think the paper was well written as well. I appreciate the staff highlighted in italics at the reporting date a number of times to reinforce that point, and that's throughout the standard. I think the issue about updating things if they're material is the way to look at changes, because I think most entities are going to want to prepare this before the reporting date to make sure that they do report out on a timely basis. But I do think that, as Bill said, the issue about what happens after the reporting date is more interesting and probably going to be a bit more challenging, especially when people would like to update something for information that does come out. And in Canada, we did have an example this last year where our central bank quite unexpectedly lowered interest rates after years of telling us they were going to raise them. So I would think most entities at the reporting date at December 31st would not have had much probability weight to lowering rates, but then changing it after the year end, but before they release their statements, would be very tempting. And so we would say something like that change in interest rates is something you probably should not be adjusting for. If you included it as a probability weighted outcome, that's great, but we're not hearing that a lot of folks are embracing that concept. They're more looking at doing what consensus view would be, and that consensus view, in this case, likely would have been rates to stay the same or go up. And so, this issue about would you be allowed to open it up and change it, I think is going to be a source of lots of discussion between auditors and regulators and preparers. And so...
You think that the principle, you understand what we're shooting
for? Well, I like the fair value sort of model, or the view of how we're going to prepare it, that we wouldn't necessarily take changes or things that are announced afterwards. But I do agree, if things are truly errors, that something was put into a forecast, but it was improperly taken from a report or from another source, clearly that would be one. But we think it would be very rare that you would be adjusting forecasts after the reporting date for information that's released.
Does anyone else want to add to what Phil and George have said? Tom?
Thank you. Yes, I was wondering about the comparison between determining the fair value and the impairment of financial assets. Because when you have to determine the fair value, you can only take into account the information that is available till the reporting date, because that is the date that you have to determine the fair value. And in the model for determining the impairment loss, the loan loss provision, I believe you should take into account information that is later available than the reporting date and gives information about the situation on the reporting date. So I'm not fully convinced that you can apply the same model in determining the fair value on one hand and determining the loan loss provision on the other hand.
I think what you mean is that in some circumstances, if you need to determine a fair value, for example, using model inputs, and you need to look at things like expected cash flows, I think you do need to take into account future expectations to determine those cash flows, and they would be expectations using the information you have available at the reporting date, which would include, you know, your current expectations of the future. So I think that's the analogy people are drawing.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Tom,
different to like a quoted price, obviously, yeah. That's on the day. But Tom, if it was more like a model level three.
Just clarification. So you would go on forever until you took into account, or you have to draw a line somewhere where you're going to start to actually report what the books and records have a date. So you have to strike a date.
Yeah, and in accordance with IAS 10, that is the date you sign off the financial statement. So, and of course, I see the operational challenges, because you have to finalize your books and you have to draw up your accounts, and there is some period. And of course, then you will look to two possible major things, and normally you come to the conclusion that you do not take into account unless there is something very material. That's another remark I would like to make, a little concern. In some of the papers, there is an explicit reference made to materiality. And in our thought, materiality is always applicable.
Mm, yep.
Mm-hmm. So we were wondering if it might give a wrong impression by sometimes mentioning materiality as a concept, because that could create the impression that it is not always applicable, or in these cases it is more relevant. And in our view, the relevance of materiality concept is in all cases the same. You have to apply it all over preparing your
financial
statement.
I think that's what we meant, but we can emphasise that. Wayne, I think you were next.
Yeah, so again, coupling with possibly the contradiction on the fair value arguments. Certainly in Australia, we're exposed a lot to the iron ore price. There was full consensus as at December of what the iron ore price was going to be, $60 a ton. Subsequently, before the reporting date, the iron ore price has fallen to $35 a ton.
Fair value thinking? Well, then if that's the way that sort of that resonates with people, then that's the way we should try and explain it. But there has to be a cutoff date, or else this will go on endlessly.
John? I'd agree with
Getting
George.
Getting excited holding your card.
Yeah. And it's only the first paper. I'd agree with George. We're looking at the expectations in cash flows at the balance sheet date. We've changed the measurement model from an incurred model to an expected loss model. I think that's closer to fair value model, and I think the examples in IAS 10 remain the same, and the principles of IAS 10 remain the same. I think the measurement basis has moved us more towards the fair value basis. It's what is the consensus expectation at the balance sheet date. Expectations can change post balance sheet date, but it's an expected loss model. I think that's the key.
Okay, thank you. Chris?
I would echo some of this analogy to fair value, and I just do see massive tension here between they're using information at reporting date, which it says twice in IFRS 9 with this IS 10 overlay. And I think if you're going to apply the overlay, it seems like what you're saying is, well, look to conditions at reporting date and think about how they would have affected expectations. And if that's what is meant, then I think it would be, we need to clearly understand that. And then I think the question of materiality is, to what extent do you need to adjust the starting point you had, you know, at the reporting date? But I think they're different concepts, and that IS 10 overlay is very different from a fair value concept, which is based on what did market participants know at the reporting date. The other thing that slightly worries me about the discussion, and it sort of slipped into the fact pattern, is this talk about, well, let's have a single consensus estimate. We get our committee of experts together and they have one view of the future. But I don't think that's really what the standard should default to. It's about expected cash flows, which means probability weighted range of estimates. And so in terms of things like the referendum, if the referendum hasn't happened, you can't say for certain that it's going to be yes or no. You can just assign some probabilities to that. And I think that's subtly that seems to be overlooked in the submission.
Helen? Just from as a preparer's point of view, you know, we talked about using the fair value analogy. I just want to be cautious that I don't think that's what the standard intends us to do, is full fair value on your loan. And so I just want to be cautious about that, because that's a different model and introduces a whole new layer into provisioning against your loans. I think the reality is there's going to be a cadence to people grabbing their macroeconomic factors, and whether you're buying it off the street or you're a large institution and you're getting it in-house, you know, it comes out every month, every 2 weeks or whatever it is, and you need to get into the cadence, you know, and tap into that of getting your data. There are going to be things that come up subsequent, and I think to Chris's point, your model is gonna have a range of expectations in there, and I think you need to look at, you know, what happened subsequent to the year, to your year end, and say, was it in my probability weighted factors, and am I comfortable with, you know, let's face it, the allowance is within a range. Am I comfortable with where I am within the range? And then you make your decision whether to adjust or not. This is, you know, this is art, not necessarily science.
I think the standard is clear, because it says really that you should use the available supportable information also about really the future economic conditions and forecast at the reporting date. And I think that is very clear. You should then not take into account then, okay, information which is then available after, because you have to do a forecast, is in a point in time a forecast. Otherwise, it is a moving target and you will never finalize it. And therefore, I think that standard clearly says, okay, you should do all that at the reporting date and with the information which are available at the reporting date.
Yes, I fully agree with what Ellen said before. I think that we are talking about a model with a range of expectation, and this model will systematically rely on some kind of events that are supposed to be applicable and appropriate for each portfolio regarding its sensitivity to the economy. We perfectly know that even before the reporting date or after the reporting date, these will be assumptions. You will never be able to model all with the global certainty. You have to make some choice. After that, I think that there is also, underlying all that, a question of transparency. Because you never know perfectly, or maybe I would say you should know that forecasts are forecasts. And so you can reasonably expect that they will not be perfectly realized, as long as you can expect that. What might be different is to say that if there is a slight difference in the assumption, that might not be so bad considering the expectation and let's say the calculation you performed. But if it raised the fact that an unexpected event and not modelized event raise some kind of issue, some kind of problem in your calculation, that means that maybe your model has to be reviewed. And so I think that there is this kind of transparency that should be pointed at too.
I think the points on the probability weighting and the fact that we're not sort of saying we think the referendum's definitely a yes or a no are well made, and we should try and make sure we capture them. George?
The only other, I mean, listening to this discussion, it's obvious to me that some of the examples in IAS 10, which probably were very on point for an incurred loss and the bankruptcy example that Hannah mentioned, I wonder whether an improvement to that in the future would be to add examples that really are more in line with expected loss type thinking. Yep. And the bankruptcy example really doesn't, although it's relevant, it doesn't quite have the same yep. importance it did before. Okay.
I think this discussion hopefully will be helpful for people, but we can also think about education material and things subsequently. Pablo?
I was thinking about reflecting on comments that have been made, and I fail to see a clear connection with what the standard is requiring. I mean, I hear about fair value, I hear about updating the model assumptions or whatever. However, what we're talking about here is, and I go back to Bill's point on the nature of the event and whether the adjustment or the adjustment having to depend on the nature of the event, we're talking about events that affect the determination at the reporting date, whether there's been a significant deterioration in credit risk or whether there has to be an adjustment in the expected credit loss calculation. So that's basically where we're pointing at. So as Bill said before, when thinking about the bankruptcy example, well, maybe that's if the credit management process has led to incorporate the correct assumptions in the estimations, that probably has already led to a determination whether there's been a significant increase before the reporting period end. So then we can talk about other kinds of examples like the referendum. I think the referendum, it all depends on the impact the outcome of the referendum might have on particular portfolios, because for some portfolios it might be a symmetrical impact depending on the yes or no outcome. For other portfolios it might be a bigger impact if there's a yes or a bigger impact if there's a no. So that drives the probability weighting in the, but it might be the case that that event is doesn't have any impact whatsoever on the portfolio, and then it has no bearing on the expected credit loss calculation. And then there's the issue on whether this is going to drive sort of like an earnings management type of. I mean, of course, we have that already. I mean, the information that arises post balance sheet, depending on how it is interpreted by management, it can drive sort of like an earnings management type of thinking. But we have that already now, and that's implicit in the subjectivity of the standard itself.
I think George's point about the example. Policing the cutoff will be an important one too. Graham.
Thank you, Sue. I've often said that the only thing I know about an estimate is that it's wrong. I think we need to be careful when we use words like, is the estimate correct? I think we should use words like, is the estimate reasonable? Is it based on reasonable and supportable information? I think when we start discussing estimates about forward-looking conditions, about being correct or incorrect, that's a really dangerous place to be. And I think that's far beyond what any accounting standard or auditing standard would require. I think Bill mentioned the importance of process. I think especially in these highly subjective forward-looking projections, the most important thing is to have a good process, a well-documented basis for your conclusions, and it's clear that you've considered the right sorts of things. If you find out information afterwards that that's disconfirming to those assumptions, but those were reasonable, supportable assumptions at the measurement date, congratulations, you've had an estimate just like every other estimate in the history of the world. You found out that it was a little bit wrong in the end. I don't think that's necessarily an indication either that there's an adjustment to be made, or when going back and validating your model, that you've got a poor model. So I think those are important considerations.
Hannah, do you want to have a go at trying to sort of sum up what you've heard?
She knows she had to do that. Good luck to her.
Singapore.
She heard a lot.
your job.
No. What I'm hearing is that we have quite a lot of emphasis in terms of looking at what's written in the standard and looking at information that's available and reasonable, supportable, available at the balance sheet date, which leads to the sort of analogy that this could be closer to looking at how we do our fair value models. But information you're looking at. But then there is also a few voices that are arguing perhaps for looking more at information that we still need to look at, our post-balance sheet event information that arises, to consider whether or not that might have a bearing.
I think most are saying it is the anchor is the reporting date, and I think the important additional thing that came out of the discussion, which I think Chris rightly pointed out, sort of wasn't emphasised as much as maybe it should have been in the paper, is the sort of notion it's not that we're trying to say yes or no to the Scottish referendum, it's more have you considered that as a something that was properly considered in terms of one of the scenarios weighted in the assessment, and bringing that through I think would also be helpful.
Yeah, so it's important that at the balance sheet date you're looking at a range of different probabilities and scenarios and taking those into account.
Okay.
All right. Let's move on then to paper three. Who is looking after that one?
Me.
Okay, you again. Okay, agenda paper three. We're looking at loan commitments here, and particularly issued loan commitments, and the interaction with the impairment requirements in IFRS 9. An issuer of a loan commitment is required to apply the impairment requirements of IFRS 9 to that loan commitment, even if the rest of IFRS 9 might not apply to the loan commitment, because they're scoped out. However, the issue arises here is whether the impairment requirements must also be applied to other types of commitments to extend credit, so not your traditional loan commitment. And two examples have been put forward by a couple of submitters, a couple of stakeholders. The first one is looking at a commitment to commence a finance lease at a date in the future. And the second one is a commitment by a retailer through the issue of a store account, for example, which would give a customer the right to credit when that customer buys goods and services from that retailer in the future. Loan commitments aren't actually defined in the standard, but the basis for conclusions explains that a loan commitment is a firm commitment to provide credit under pre-specified terms and conditions. And hence, when we're looking at whether something falls into the scope of the impairment requirements, the first question to ask is whether the agreement we're looking at actually contains, meets that explanation, that it is a firm commitment to provide credit under pre-specified terms and conditions. And clearly the answer will depend upon the particular situations you have in front of you. But we also note that the overarching scope of IFRS 9 is that it applies to financial instruments. And this is further reinforced in the basis of conclusions in paragraph BC 5.244, which refers to loan commitments as being these financial instruments when looking at the scope, discussing the development of the scope. And hence the second question to ascertain is whether the agreement that we're looking at contains that commitment to provide credit also meets the definition of a financial instrument as defined in IS 32. Now, the objective of this group and this session is not to debate features in IS 32 and the definition of a financial instrument itself. This falls outside our remit and doesn't relate to IFRS 9 nor to impairment. But we would be interested in your views on the general approach outlined in the agenda paper, that the loan commitment requirements for impairment would apply when the agreement we're looking at is both a firm commitment to extend credit and, secondly, a financial instrument. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much for your explanation. Okay, so I'm Tetsuo. And so let me share my view about the commitment of finance risk first. I originally thought from a credit risk perspective, so it may be better to recognize the expected credit loss for the commitment of the finance risk. But however, from an accounting purpose, I don't think the standard requires the entity to recognize the expected credit losses for the commitment of finance risk. This first paper states that we should ask two questions to make a judgment about whether the commitment is within the scope of impairment requirements. The first question is there a loan commitment? So as Hannah said, there is no definition, but there is a description of the loan commitment. That is, loan commitments are firm commitments to provide credit under prescribed terms and conditions. And in my understanding, so most of the commitment of lease, finance lease meet this description. Based on this paper, a second question we should ask is, does it meet the definition of financial instrument? So IAS 32 defines a financial instrument as any contract that gives rise to a financial asset of one entity and a financial liability or equity instrument of another entity. I don't think the commitment of finance lease does not meet this definition, because before the entity fulfills the obligation to transfer the right to use an asset to lessee, that contract never gives rise to financial asset or financial liability before the commencement date. So based on this point, I consider the commitment of finance lease is not a financial instrument. Therefore, I think the commitment of finance lease is out of scope of the impairment requirements. And secondly, about the store accounts. In this paper, the retailer does not have any contractual obligation to sell goods or services to a customer. The retailer can refuse to sell goods or services at any time on its discretion. That's why I think it is not a firm commitment to provide a credit, and it does not meet the definition of the loan commitment. Therefore, it is also out of scope of impairment requirements. Okay. So this is my view.
Okay, thank you. So you agree, what we're trying to focus on mainly in the paper is whether you agree that there's two questions to be answered. Firstly, is there a loan commitment? And secondly, is it a financial instrument? So you agree that those are the two questions you would need to answer to decide if you're in scope? Okay. Chris.
I think largely agree with what Tetsuo said. I think the paper is very helpful in terms of cutting through these rather complex scope paragraphs. I agree that the two questions are very relevant and should be asked. I also think there's a third question potentially, which is there may be another scope exception, which I think you should consider in these questions. Then maybe.
Which is?
Well, is there another scope exception as well?
Okay.
So if I mention the finance lease, I guess, so I'll have to, I'm afraid, you know, veer into whether I think these things are financial or not. But I would agree with the analysis, maybe it's quite old school, that if you have a contract to perform some non-financial service in exchange for a cash payment, until somebody's perform the non-financial bit, you don't have a financial instrument. And so I'd agree in terms of a commitment to a finance lease, there's no financial instrument until the lessor has provided the property that then, as it were, triggers the obligation to pay the lease rentals. So I would say you get there and say there's not a financial instrument. But I also think, even if you did think it were a financial instrument, I would look to the additional scope exemption that says, well, finance leases are scoped out, except in certain respects, and then this is not this type of commitment under finance lease seems to be something within the scope of IS 17. Well, the lease is certainly within the scope of IS 17, and this bit is not scoped explicitly into IFRS 9, so I would say the scope exception applies to this, you can also keep this out even if it were an entrance. And then on the store accounts, I think, again, you can get into a discussion as to whether there's really a commitment. But I would say that even if the retailer had a firm commitment to supply goods and services on credit, that would not be a financial instrument because it's a contract to supply goods and services with deferred payment terms, and don't see that as a financial instrument until goods are delivered. Or there's some other term in the contract that says money has to be paid up front, irrespective of the performance.
So I don't really want to get into too much of the financial instrument definition, as you know, but in terms of your argument, in terms of generally how you read the scope paragraphs, that you're probably right, there are three questions. So is it a loan commitment, is it a financial instrument, and then is there another relevant paragraph that gets you out? I'd agree with that sort of general proposition. So I guess then if you thought that that got you back out again, you'd need to be convinced that the rights and obligations under the lease were captured by IAS 17.
I think then you get into another detail.
I don't want to answer that, but that's what you're arguing.
Because is it the lease that's subject to it, or is it the specific rights and obligations? Or how would you read it precisely? But it's a relevant question as to is another scope.
Okay. Okay, I think that's a fair observation. Just housekeeping, does that mean that everything Chris just said was not heard by anybody?
I think because you've got
the side mic should be okay.
I think it would have been heard, but not.
Okay.
Should I move?
Is your red light on? I can't
see. No, it won't come on.
That's just not coming on.
All right, just stay there for the moment, and maybe we'll need to move you, and we'll just double check and see if it's heard. We don't want your important statements to be missed.
I thought
maybe world.
Deliberate. Maybe.
Sadly, I don't have that power. And I wouldn't have used it anyway, Chris. George.
So for the store account example, and again, I know you don't really want to delve into IAS 32, but you do mention it in the paper. But the paragraph you don't mention is AG 20, and to me, these store accounts are really contracts to buy or sell non-financial items, and they are executory in my view in nature, and therefore they wouldn't qualify as a financial instrument either. So just another reference to reinforce the conclusion.
All right, thank you. Does anybody have anything to add on to this point? No? Wow.
Just the light's not working, Chris. I think everything else works, so you can...
You could still be heard, though, just to be clear.
So I was getting excited we were making some time up.
Sorry.
No pressure.
It's a clarification. So on the store cards, I think... My understanding of those is that there's normally something in the terms and conditions that on the point of activation you're actually on the hook, and so you should be counting those into scope.
I think you still go through the same process, but yes, you need to decide whether or not you've got a firm commitment, which I think is where you're going.
Yeah.
And then a second question is financial instrument, and then points like the one George just raised can be relevant.
Yeah.
But it gets quickly very sort of non-impairment related and much more techie accounting related. So I think the main thing we have heard, and I won't make you sum up this time, Hannah, I'll do it for you because I'm a sort of kind sort of woman, is consistent with what we've got in the paper with a couple of extra additions about whether or not there's another scope exception that you would need to consider, which I think is a fair point, and also George's point in terms of when you're looking at the financial instrument guidance, AG 20 might be relevant for the store card, which we didn't specifically mention. So I think that's helpful.